When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you look for it, every day has cause for celebration. Celebrate a friend for their promotion, baby, wedding, life thing. Celebrate yourself for keeping the couch warm. It's no easy feat, especially if it's a big couch. Or maybe you just want to celebrate living in 2023, where you can get beer, wine, and spirits delivered from Drizly in under 60 minutes without leaving said couch. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com and get your favorite drinks delivered today.
Hey, this is Corbin Reef, the author of the biography of Chris Cornell, Total Effing Godhead. You're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
Like to welcome to the program Corbin Reef, author of the book Total Fucking Godhead, a biography of Chris Cornell. Any hesitation on throwing an F-bomb in the title?
No, you know, with a guy like Chris Cornell, you just got to go for it. You know, that's the way he operated in his musical life. And I decided, you know, if I'm going to write a book about them, you know, I feel like that title captured, you know, what he was, what the essence of Chris Cornell is as best I could. So there was no trepidation whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, we're past that point maybe in pop culture, but yeah, I love the title, but I was just curious.
Yeah, for sure.
What is your relationship then to grunge or the music in general? You know, this is a podcast that celebrates the music of that period. Were you a fan at the time, coming in late? Just give us a little background on you.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I was a kid still, like around, you know, I was a younger kid when grunge first exploded, but, you know, MTV was constantly on in our house. And, you know, I remember, you know, this song, like Teen Spirit video coming on, the Jeremy video, you know, Black Hole Sun video specifically was one that was just, I mean, when I first saw that really blew my mind. Yeah. And, you know, I saw all those bands and, you know, my friends and I would listen to those records and those CDs all the time. Well, we used CDs. And I've always had a love for that music. And then moving up to Seattle and becoming a music journalist and talking to so many of those people who were involved in that scene and seeing them live and shows and stuff, it just, you know, further kind of deepened my respect for what was going on. And just music I've always loved.
Talk a little bit about that then. When would you have moved to Seattle and when would you say your music journalism career kind of started?
Yeah, I moved to the Seattle area. It was in the 2000s, but okay. I moved up here because I was in the Army at the time, and I got stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord down near Tacoma, and I deployed to Iraq and, you know, all that stuff, and came back. And after I got out, I went to Evergreen State College in Olympia and just started writing about music because, you know, that's what you do here in college, I suppose. And then I started writing for the Seattle Weekly and the Seattle Times and, you know, Rolling Stone, Spin, all sorts of different places, and kind of built a career accidentally just because I was passionate about it, to be honest.
Right on. That's awesome. That kind of makes it seem almost obvious that you would end up writing a book like the one you did.
Yeah, it's weird. I was kind of like preparing for it this whole time without knowing it, I suppose, you know, building, you know, a wealth of knowledge and resources and people who I could really lean on and talk to that kind of helped me fill out the story, because it was an incredible story and one that hadn't really been told fully before. And, you know, after Chris passed, you know, I just felt a huge impetus to make his music legacy, you know, known. I mean, there was at the time, there was only one book, I think, written about Soundgarden. It was published in 1997 when they were still a band. They hadn't broken up the first time yet.
Okay.
But there's all these, there's books about Nirvana and Sub Pop and grunge and Pearl Jam. And there's all these great books, and it's fantastic that it's written about them. But, you know, Soundgarden kind of, and Chris specifically, got a short shrift a little bit in his life in that regard. And, you know, I just did what I could to kind of amend the record and let people know, you know, what his lasting impact would be.
Out of like, well, you can broaden out as much as you want, but let's focus on the big four. Would Soundgarden have been your band out of those four, the Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, Nirvana deal?
You know, I was like most people, you know, I love Nirvana and I love Soundgarden, and Soundgarden, my favorite band of all time, to be candid, is Led Zeppelin. Hmm. And, you know, I kind of equate Soundgarden to the Led Zeppelin of the Seattle rock bands. You know, Nirvana's kind of the Beatles, the Pearl Jam's kind of the Who, and Soundgarden is Led Zeppelin to me. So that was what I gravitated to, you know, long guitar solos and you know, loud, abrasive music that kind of goes on a long time, Slaves and Bulldozers, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, that's just kind of what I like. So absolutely, I gravitated to them.
Would that make Alice in Chains the Kiss?
Well, you know, they were like a hair metal band for a little while, so yeah. Maybe they're the Motley Crue. I don't know. Yeah.
It sounds like you're a little younger than I am. You mentioned you were a teenager kind of when this stuff broke. So 1992, how old are you?
92. I was way younger than that. I was five years old.
Oh, wow. Okay. Right on. That's actually really encouraging. So you kind of got into the music after the scene, you know, would have been basically, you know, definitely past its pinnacle.
Yeah. No, it was gone by the time I pretty much found the music and everything. Sorry,
sure.
My dog is following me with a speaker toy. Go in the garage here. No, yeah, the music scene was pretty much, it had blown up.
You have no idea how many times dogs get involved in these things.
You know, he's a 13-year-old puppy, and he demands my attention pretty much all times.
Right on.
I was late to the scene, but I definitely I loved it from the time I saw it, and it really, like I said, mm-hmm. had a profound impact. And when I got up here, starting to be able to talk to these people, you know, Jerry Cantrell, Kim Thiel, you know, all these different, Mike McCready, all these different people I've interviewed over the years. Just, you know, I've just always had a deep appreciation for it and kind of wanted to, you know, place it in its history the best I could, you know?
Cool. You know, you mentioned in your foreword that as litigation over Chris's estate started, it started to get harder and harder to get people to open up for the book. Are there any specific examples you can get into without, you know, getting in any trouble or...
Nah, I'd rather not. You know, I kind of left it the way it was in the book for a reason. It's just it's not really worth it to kind of hash all that out again. It was a fun and challenging and amazing process to put it together. And everybody who talked to me and everybody on the record and off, you know, I'll always appreciate the fact they took the time to give me some knowledge or fill me in on some insights. And it was definitely a labor of love for sure.
Cool. Let me ask you something that I've kind of brought up with a handful of the guests I've had on. Because as I go through each one of these records, you know, I have to do some research and get stories about how it was made, talk to, you know, do all the kind of digging, right? And as much as it's fun to kind of get sucked back to that time, I would have been in college when like Nirvana broke. So it was a real fun time to kind of have that change in music and be and kind of go with the flow. But aside from that, you're constantly reminded of people that we've lost along the way, you know what I mean, including
right.
Chris. But it there gets to be a little bit of a darkness and a weight to this whole process, just from my end and what I'm doing now as someone who actually developed spent the time in the research and the interview to put a book like this together. Did you ever feel something like that yourself, like where like it just got a little heavy just for a little bit? Or
oh yeah, absolutely. That's kind of what I mean. I think I might have been finished a little bit earlier writing it and putting it together had that not kind of been the case. You know, there was, especially the last chapters. You know, when you kind of know what's coming down the road,
yeah.
And you're kind of. I mean, when you're writing it, you're kind of writing like in the present tense because you really want to put people in the kind of place, you know, where Chris was at in his career. So when I was writing about 1991, I wasn't thinking about what happened in 2017. I was kind of thinking about what happened in 1991. And in the process of doing that, it kind of made Chris I grew a lot of attachment to him, you know, and through kind of doing that, just kind of learning more about him as a person and talking to all these people that knew and loved him so much. But by the time it got to those, you know, those pivotal kind of final chapters. It was very difficult, and it took a long time to kind of get them the gumption to put it together and do it with the respect and the justice that final act, you know, deserves. It got to be tough for sure.
You know, one of the people that, you know, probably one of the biggest people to go during that time was Kurt Cobain, of course. Now, there's some stories in your book and other ones that I've read that he could be just a little bit prickly on the topic of Soundgarden. Like, it seems like he liked the band, but for some reason, I mean, he was a little harder on Pearl Jam probably, but for the most part, he seemed to support the Seattle scene, with the exception of kind of those two bands. And I don't know, it just seemed odd to me that Kurt would have, I don't know, some kind of issue. Do you any backstory there that you can share?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's an element of Kurt Cobain when he was in the media that he kind of knew what he was doing when he was talking to journalists. You know, they were looking for juicy quotes, and, you know, he was more than willing to play the game and okay, kind of, you know, pick fights with Guns N' Roses and do all sorts of crazy stuff.
Well, that one I understood.
But, you know, I know he had a lot of admiration for Chris. I know he had a lot of admiration for Soundgarden. You know, Ben Shepherd, as you probably would read for those who have read the book, you know, toured with Nirvana, Soundgarden's bassist these days, toured with Nirvana as he was supposed to be their second guitarist, but he ended up kind of working the merch table for a while. And he was really close friends with them. And, you know, when Kurt died, it really impacted the band in a tremendous way. They all had a tremendous respect for him. And I think that, you know, Soundgarden was around a lot longer than Nirvana. They were around since about 84, 85, and Nirvana kind of, you know, hit the scene around 89 or so. So they were kind of the big brothers of the scene in the first place. So there was definitely an element of looking up in some respect to what Soundgarden was by Nirvana.
That was a fun part of the book, at least very well documented anyway, was because I knew Soundgarden had been around longer, and I had a little bit of understanding of the other history even before I started this show. But it's really detailed, and it really hits home, and, like, you know, 84 to 92 is a long time. Just how much?
Long time.
I mean, and you know, you don't really, even if, you know, I knew it back then, I don't think I ever really tied it together until I read your books. They have quite a bit of history ahead of those guys.
Yeah, they really did. You know, it's so funny that Soundgarden ended up being like the band that broke out kind of last. Super Unknown hit in 94. Nevermind already came out in 91. You know, Pearl Jam's 10 had come out in 92, I believe. And you know what? Not to slight Bad Motorfinger, which is, you know, I'm going to go on record as saying Soundgarden's best album. Or, Super Unknown's their best. I'll say Bad Motorfinger's my favorite. But you know, it took them quite a bit of time to break out to the, you know, to the degree those other bands did. I mean, even Alice in Chains. But they had, it was a long, long, long haul between going from, you know, independent record label of Sub Pop to then another independent record label, SST, because they wanted to make, you know, a record for the same, you know, label that made Black Flag albums and Minuteman albums. It was kind of important to them. And then they go to, you know, A&M and do their major label thing in around 89. So, you know, they had a lot of road ahead of them before they kind of hit the major national consciousness.
Okay. One of the things that you touch on in the book too, that you know, comes up in other things that we've done, is Hiro Yamamoto, of course, quitting the band after the Louder Than Love, I think, tour. But you know, I think touring was one of his reasons for not wanting to do it, but yet he continued to stay in the music business. I always thought that was a bit conflicted.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's so funny you bring that up. The last show I saw before the quarantine happened, I was supposed to see the Strokes, but the last show I ended up seeing in February, I think, was Heroes band Stereo Donkey in Bellingham, Washington. And it's like a fun surf rock band that he's got going on up there now. And it's he's still doing it, still hitting the bass and sounding great.
They must not tour.
Yeah, no, he keeps it close to home these days, I think.
Another thing that your book did a great job of, it's probably the best retelling of the whole Temple of the Dog period, because I was going largely off of memory. Now, to share a little bit with you, I was working at the college radio station when that record was initially dropped, and Soundgarden, none of that stuff had really blown up. In my mind, the timeline was very far apart from when that record actually blew up, but from when it was released. But everything I've researched never really combined that. So I started to think maybe my 30-year-old memory on that time was just a little bit foggy, you know, but you do break it down. It was actually re-released in 92, kind of. Almost a full year after it came out, after Pearl Jam kind of broke, after Nirvana had obviously started dominating everything, and that music video, if it existed before that kind of second runaround, I never saw it. So that was interesting to find out that they actually shot and released that initially for the whole release of the thing. But yeah, there was a big gap between when that thing, that, and it's amazing to me that album got released and recorded when none of these people are heavy hitters in the industry at that time.
Yeah, it speaks to the nature of what that project was really about. It was a passion project, you know, that Chris and you know, the Pearl Jam members had written, you know, for their friend. It wasn't intended originally to be this, you know, blockbuster era-defining supergroup right. album that it ended up becoming. You know, what basically happened is, you know, singles, the Cameron Crowe film drops, Bad Motorfinger drops, 10 drops, Nirvana blows up. And all of a sudden, the record labels remember, oh, hey, you know, they made a record together, didn't they? So they bring up they actually filmed the music video before, but they recut it with more footage of Eddie involved, looking wistfully off into the reeds and stuff, and put it into the, you know, and the MTV rotation, and then the rest is history.
Yeah, that record. What are your thoughts on that? I adore that album so much.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's to me, it's unimpeachable. I mean, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, music and it coming from an authentic place, you know, it really doesn't get much more authentic than that Temple of the Dog record and what it means. And I'll say this, I'll make this claim. It's something I actually really do believe, is that Call Me a Dog on that Temple of the Dog record is by far, I think, Chris's best vocal performance across his career. Call me a dog. Well, that's fair. The way he croons in the opening, and it's just so mournful, and then the screech at that very end where he hits that high register. Just, what an incredible...
Oh, man.
Exactly, it's just... exactly. But he works for it, you know? He really, you know, he builds to that moment, and it's just so cinematic. I really... Wow, what an album.
We can just gush on his singing just a little bit. One of the things that I think he did that few singers with his range were able to, I mean, there are others, but a lot of them struggle with this thing I'm about to talk about, where they can do that rangy high stuff or that really powerful singing, but Chris could really drop it smooth into kind of that lower register, kind of just slightly above talking melodic kind of thing in a way that I think is really, look, it's not easy to do. So, I mean, but he was just a master of it. And that song is a great example of that.
Oh, yeah. It's Beyond the Wheels, another great example of that, too, where it starts off just so brooding and then it shoots off into the atmosphere. And it's funny. I was talking to some of the engineers who made that Audioslave album with him. And it was kind of illuminating to learn that, you know, at that point of his career, he was doing like Coachies, just sitting down in a chair, hitting those high, incredible screams, just kind of sitting down in a chair with a mic in front of him in Seattle. It's just,
his legs crossed.
Know, some people are superhuman that way, you know?
He's holding a cup of tea.
Exactly.
Yeah. He was one of a kind. Well, you know, and the other thing about Temple of Dog, it was largely, as far as how it was pushed, especially once it blew up, it was like, this is an album that Chris wrote about Andrew Wood, when really only the first two songs were written specifically with Andy in mind. And then once he brought in other people to collaborate with, the album kind of grew organically.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he'd written those songs On the Road, Say Hello to Heaven. Was one of them that he wrote while on the road in Europe. And he kind of stuffed them in his bag. And when he came back to Seattle, he made demos of them and kind of passed them off to his wife, Susan Silver, who passed them off to Jeff Ament, the bassist in what had been Mother Love Bone and became Pearl Jam in some respects. And then him and Stone Gossard got together, also from Pearl Jam. And originally the idea was to kind of work and do sort of like a covers album with those two songs and record some of Andy's songs. But, you know, there was some pushback, I guess, from in the community about doing something like that. So they just went back to the drawing board and wrote, you know, 8 extra songs for the album, and the rest is history.
I don't want to bring it down, but I just recently lost a high school friend, and I kind of, I've been in the middle of all this, but that the lyrics to Say Hello to Heaven, I mean, Jesus, what a brilliant song. I mean, so poignant, and when you break it down, and then when something personal happens to you and you grab onto it, it's just like, man, this guy, what the hell? He got everything. You know what I mean? He was taller than most people. He was good looking, and he's got this voice, and he can write these songs. It usually isn't that stacked in your favor. You know what I mean?
Oh no, I totally agree with you. And it's funny. I think those other elements of him that we talked about just a minute ago, you know, him as a singer, his physical presence, and all the things that are, you know, dynamic about him that you see him kind of cause to obscure a lot of his ability and power as a songwriter. You know, he's writing in these strange tunings and these odd time signatures, and he's bringing this vivid, like, you know, really impactful lyric writing, you know, and songs of, you know, like 4th of July, even on Sound Super Unknown, which is just this like acid nightmare of a song. It's, and then Black Hole Sun. I mean, it just fell on black days, you know, Outshine. You just making up words at that point. You know? Just, he was really creative lyricist. And, you know, I think that so many of his other talents kind of obscured that for some people.
Yeah, you know, well, I mean, he was a bit of an Adonis.
Not a bad problem to have in the grand scheme of things.
Right. In those specific categories, I don't pity him too much. But
right, exactly.
You're 100% correct. Well, I should probably let you know, Corbin, that I'm in Minnesota. I'm born and raised. I'm calling you from St. Paul, Minnesota. Your book tells a story about the lion feeling Minnesota from Outshined. Came from him wearing some awkward outfit, and he kind of sees himself in the mirror, and he sees kind of this gloomy, dark guy, which is the feeling Minnesota part, and then he's got this kind of goofy surfer outfit on, and well, of course, that really isn't much of a compliment to say you're feeling Minnesota, so. That was a fun story, though.
It was, yeah. He was on tour again in Europe. It was another day. I don't think he knew what town he was in, and he was feeling like absolute shit. And he probably thought he looked like shit, but then when he looked in the mirror, he looked like, you know, Chris Cornell looks, and he's like, holy shit, you know. And then that line came. It's actually, he credited as being one of the most personal lines that he'd ever written. It kind of opened up a looking California, feeling Minnesota. It kind of opened up a whole new world of songwriting for him, where he realized he could write about himself directly and have it translate universally. It was a weird moment that ended up being really important to his growth as a songwriter.
So as Minnesotans, we should take a little bit of pride in giving him the inspiration for feeling like shit.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you have the replacements. You're fine. It's going to be okay, Minnesota.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen the movie Kingpin, but it's kind of like being, you know, your last name being like a Munson, you know, whatever in that movie.
Yeah, exactly. Feeling Michigan doesn't really have the same ring to it anyway.
That's a good way to put it. Could have used Iowa. I don't know. Anyway.
Feeling North Dakota.
Hey, now we're talking. Now we're on to something.
Now we're workshopping it.
All right. Michael Beinhorn comes in to produce Super Unknown. And we had Michael on the show, and he did not shy away of the stories of conflict between the band and him. What did you find out in that level?
It was a long, long, contentious process. You know, they were banging their heads against the wall for a long time. You know, just cooking up demos to kind of, everyone kind of knew that Soundgarden was going to be the next big thing, or if they kind of pulled it off with Super Unknown, it was kind of expected that, okay, everyone's waiting on this record to see what they're going to do next after Bad Motorfinger. So there was a lot of impetus to really get it right, and they were writing a lot of material and sending it to Beinhorn, and some of it was good, some of it was bad, and eventually they get into the studio, and then 3 weeks later they leave to go on tour with Neil Young.
Yeah.
And then they get back, and it's just this really intense process of trial and error and working to trying to get drum sounds out of Matt Cameron, who's more of a, I mean, Matt Cameron's one of the greatest drummers of all time. He's basically a human metronome who can solve math problems to a level that is just unfathomable. But Beinhorn put him through the paces and tried to get, you know, the best drum sound, and, you know, Matt didn't always like that, and it and then with Chris, you know, he ended up recording his own vocals by himself that night when everyone else kind of left the studio, because, you know, he was able to kind of direct himself that way. But yeah, no, it wasn't always fun, but there was some fraught moments, but, you know, the end result speaks for itself.
Yeah, you know, well, one of the things that I found surprising was that, especially when you consider how long they've been a band at this point, was that they were very unified still. And like, so it wasn't like a lot of times when you have a producer that butts head, it's really one or two guys, and there's some hurt feelings involved. Where this was really more, the way I put it to Michael was that it was kind of like a circling the wagons, and he agreed. He thought that, yeah, they definitely were a group that put a wall up between him. It wasn't like he had a hard time working with one of the members or two of them, you know?
Right, yeah. And yeah, they were definitely a unified front for the longest time. And, you know, the music and the purity meant the most to them. And they were a tight group. They'd known each other for so long at that point, too. They had a really great shorthand and the chemistry between them. And, you know, when you've been in a van with someone and getting, you know, doing things like getting busted by the DEA in Louisiana, you know, 2 years, 3 years earlier, you know, it kind of tends to bond you together. And when an outsider comes in, it's definitely hard to break through those walls.
Yeah, it definitely can be. But you know, it can also, like, when you've been in a band for 10 years, you can get kind of sick of each other and like, I'm so sick of this guy getting all the attention in the studio or something, you know. So whatever. It's refreshing to see that they were at least, you know, together as a group. I think that
definitely.
You know, and also, you know, conflict like that can actually, you know, help the creative process. But
I think they also have a really deep mutual respect for each other's talents. You know, Chris's talent's undeniable, Matt's talent's undeniable, Ben was bringing some incredibly interesting songs at that point, and then Kim Style is one of the most incredible textured guitar players to ever, you know, to do it in the metal, you know, rock realm. It's, you know, and then I think there was a lot of respect for each other's abilities, and you know, it kind of translates when you hear the music.
Yeah, you can definitely, and that's a really great point, too, because the more you research this band, the more that comes home, that there really wasn't like, you know, as the band grew bigger, it wasn't like Chris's star was like he was trying to pursue that as much. He seemed to generally like collaborating with almost any project that he worked on.
Yeah, he was a great collaborator. And it's interesting that, you know, when people for the longest time thought Soundgarden, you know, the first face they would see was Kim Thayil. You know, he was the one in the guitar magazines a lot of times.
Yeah.
You know, Chris had his great solo career, but, you know, in terms of Soundgarden, Kim was kind of one of the more identifiable figures of the band. But, you know, Chris is a collaborator. You know, he worked with so many different people through the years. You know, writing it, this book was almost like a who's who of rock history that he worked with, you know, from Johnny Cash to the Rage Against the Machine guys to, you know, even working with Timbaland in 2009 on that Scream record, which was, you know, panned. But, you know, it was an interesting choice. I'll say that, you know, it's not the greatest album in the world, but, you know, if you want to do something different with your solo career, which he did, his solo career is very fascinating because it was very, very different from basically every other music he made, you know, from adult contemporary to the kind of hip hop influences and then kind of acoustically, you know, with Higher Truth near the end of his life. You know, he was always kind of willing to go down paths in his solo work that were very unexpected.
I am a big fan, even when I don't like the output, of just an artist doing that. I just try something. Why not? I mean, I'm with you. I don't think it's that great of a record, but it's not as bad as it gets talked about sometimes.
We got King Animal 3 years later. Everyone was fine, you know?
Yeah, I guess. All right. Well, for Down on the Upside, they kind of kept it in-house. They brought in, his name is Andy Adam Casper?
Adam Casper, yeah.
All right. I'm doing okay there then. And he was basically the in-house engineer at Bad Animal Studio. So he worked with them on Super Unknown. But they co-produced it with him. It was surprising to hear how fractured. Now at this point, maybe the band is starting to get sick of each other because they're really not working together a lot on this album, right?
No, I mean, not really. There was kind of a confusion for a while that, you know, Kim thought they were doing rehearsals for the next album, and they were like, Kim, the record's almost done. You know, there was definitely some communication issues going on at that point.
Not the way to find that message out.
No, exactly. I mean, 1996, when they were working on that record at Stone Gossard's studio, Studio Litho, by that time, they'd been together for a long time, and I think that, you know, there was an element of, you know, looking for new things, new worlds to conquer. You know, the scene in Seattle had been kind of collapsing. You know, they weren't, you know, the necessarily the hot new things anymore. And I think that it just, you know, is one of those cases where, you know, just time got the best of them. And, you know, after the end of that album, when they broke up in Hawaii, you know, I don't think anyone saw that coming, but it was, I think it was just kind of an example of a band who kind of ran out of steam for a little bit and needed to kind of explore new ventures.
Yeah, and I'll save it the story for a tease to help sell maybe your book for anybody that listens. But I had never heard that story about how the last show went down. So that was really some great insight that somebody who reads the book can get.
There you go. Yeah, check it out for sure.
Well, now, before reading your book, I had heard that Chris largely kept his, drug and alcohol use pretty much in check during most of Soundgarden's, prime time. Your book kind of confirms that, but it sounds like basically after the breakup of Soundgarden, that's when maybe some of the, the mental issues that he's probably had to kind of work around with most of his life start taking over. And then, of course, the substance abuse kind of starts to pick up there. And that wasn't the most comfortable thing to read in your book.
No, it wasn't. It was the most uncomfortable thing to write about as well. Near the end of when they were kind of working on Down on the Upside, Soundgarden always kind of been a drinking band. They always had that reputation, but Chris was kind of drinking more and more near the end of Soundgarden, and once Audioslave started in around 2001, 2002, he started getting into different sorts of substances, opioids and things like that nature, and eventually went to rehab. And oddly, he went to rehab for twice as long as he was supposed to. He stayed for like 2 months rather than one. Mm. And he got clean. Actually, they checked him out of rehab specifically to film the Cochise music video. And then checked him back in, and he completed his treatment there. And it was something he battled with, it was a part of who he was.
And you mentioned the Audioslave thing, and I had forgotten some of that drama. Because it was reported back in the day that it was such a poorly kept secret that they were getting together that I knew about it in Minnesota. But then there was a bit of a split for a little while. Then all of a sudden it's back on. You kind of detail that in the book.
Yeah, it was weird. They had a management issue. Basically, it was they both had different managers and they couldn't agree on which management team to go with. So they both fired their respective managers and hired a new management team. Chris worked out his stint in rehab, and then they were able to get that record out. And it leaked too. That record leaked for
back when that was a thing.
Time. Yeah, exactly. Someone had gotten hold of the files and shared them online, and song titles were wrong, and there was poor mixes with scratch vocals and stuff. So there was a lead time where people kind of had a chance to listen to this music and didn't feel exactly positive about it in that way too. So when the record finally hit, I think people were primed to tag it as a supergroup. Also, the leak had happened, so it wasn't necessarily fresh, and they didn't get the biggest reception coming out of the gate. But I think that time will vindicate that record, because Show Me How to Live, Gasoline, Getaway Car, The Last Remaining Light, Shadow on the Sun, those are incredible songs, and they deserve their due.
Now, did you over the course of researching, did you find out who leaked it?
No, I didn't. There was some theories, but I couldn't confirm anything, so I wouldn't want to say. I wouldn't want to put him on blast.
Even if I say, can you share an unconfirmed theory?
Well, I'll tell you, it had to be someone who had to access to the tapes, is what I'll say. But I wouldn't be able to verify anything.
Okay. did you hear it?
Oh yeah, you could still find the if you dig deep enough on the internet, you can find the leaks and the scratch vocal stuff on YouTube and different downloading sites and things. It's out there.
I wonder if when someone reads that book now, someone younger, or someone that just didn't pay that much attention to this stuff, to understand how big a deal that really was.
Yeah, it was tremendous. I mean, back then, a leak could destroy you. I mean, it would all this time, months and hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like even just the Cochise video, not even take into account that what it cost to record the album with Rick Rubin, of all people, who's not cheap, in L.A. For the time they did rehearsing, but the Cochise video cost $750,000.
That's amazing.
To have a leak happen and kind of hurt that rollout. I mean, it didn't hurt them, and it went multiple times platinum, so didn't hurt them too bad. But I mean, it definitely didn't help things.
And the visual of Chris doing press interviews in treatment was pretty amazing.
Yeah, you got to do what you got to do. He was a guy who took his responsibilities not too lightly. He was willing to even admit where he was when he was on the phone at the payphone at the facility talking to these journalists and you know, shout out to him for that.
Would this still been in the day when, like, prepaid phone cards were a popular thing? Was he using that?
Perhaps. I actually don't know.
Another thing that I kind of forgot about, that Cuba gig, that was a really big deal with Audioslave going to Cuba.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was a massive concert, too. Tens of thousands of people showed up for that show, and it was a... You know, American artists had kind of visited before and done small scale, you know, things, mm-hmm. cultural exchanges. But that Audioslave concert, no one had ever attempted anything of that enormity. You know, I think the Rage Against the Machine guys had wanted to do something like that in Cuba for a long time. And there was, you know, reasons why they hadn't done it in Rage. But, you know, when the Audioslave got the opportunity, they went for it. And it was a whole, it was like a military operation trying to get that whole thing put together. But, you know, ultimately kind of broke down that barrier and, you know, more bands like the Rolling Stones and you know, normalizing our Cuba relations, you know, as America has in the last, you know, 5-6 years. You know, who knows, you know, what kind of impact that concert has had.
Exactly. I mean, and that would have still been at the time when the travel ban was in effect, if I recall.
So, yeah, exactly. They had to hire like Cuban stagehands, Cuban, you know, film crew, like everything had to be done like in the island, and then they couldn't like, it was a whole just a logistical nightmare to kind of get it put together, but you know, in the end it worked out, and if you get the DVD, I would definitely watch it, because it was one of the it's one of the first few occasions where they started playing like Soundgarden songs, Rage songs in their set, you know, together, and that's fantastic.
And you mentioned that, like, you know, when he first went into treatment here, he's fairly new to the band with the Audioslave guys, and they were very supportive and were actually involved in his intervention. I don't know that much about them as people, and I don't recall reading it in your book. Were they kind of straight edge dudes, just casual drinkers, or what, do you know anything on that level?
Not really. I didn't really kind of go into that. I'll say that they really did have his back in a real and profound way. I think, you know, all those guys really stepped up and, you know, they had their own different things in their past with different people. And, you know, they, when they kind of got Audioslave together, it was important for them to stand behind Chris, and especially Timothy Comerford. You know, he really, of all the people in that band was went out of his way to help Chris and be there for him. And, I think Chris always really appreciated that.
It was reassuring, I guess, because, you know, with rock music, you know, there's just being sober, but having to go back to that career can have its own, you know, I don't know, hurdles, I guess. But
oh, for sure. Yeah, no, absolutely.
When did Chris divorce Susan? When did Chris and Susan get divorced? Maybe I should say it like that.
Yeah, I think it was around 2004 or so.
I'm sorry, say it again. Like, was it just before Audioslave, or?
It was during the Audioslave
okay.
era. Okay.
And he got married to Vicky fairly fast after that. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't have anything else on that, I guess. I thought it was interesting. I remember at the time that Chris was living in Paris, and that came up in the book. It seemed like a very Chris Cornell thing to do.
We're wearing John Bravados and opening up restaurants.
Yeah,
wild,
why
so.
Not, man? Life is
live
good.
Your life, you know.
on the Audioslave thing, I was kind of hoping there'd be a little more detail on the breakup. Did you talk to any of those guys? Was that an area that it was difficult to get some information out? Because it's a couple paragraphs, if I remember right.
Yeah, it was a weird thing. You know, they recorded 3 albums in like 4 years.
Yeah.
I mean, they recorded a tremendous amount of material. And then, you know, Chris did the James Bond theme song, and the Rage guys got like an offer to do, you know, a reunion with Zach De La Roca at Coachella. And it just seemed like a natural sort of same thing with Soundgarden. There's almost no story there. It's weird. There's these non-stories to Chris's, you know, band disintegrations, but they kind of just decided to go their separate ways, almost independent or equal with each other. And it kind of worked out in the end. I mean, you know, Chris did his solo stuff for a while and then reunited with Soundgarden and the Rage guys, you know,
yeah.
The pandemic can never end. We will hopefully see them again here soon.
Yeah, I guess. Well, they do eventually, the Soundgarden guys get back together kind of to, I don't know, start a website, start selling stuff, and that leads to a reunion. Something that I was hoping to get a little more detail on. Do you have any idea what Kim Thayil did for a decade? Because he kind of just went away.
Yeah, he just kind of hung out. I mean, he wasn't really, you know, too pressed to kind of to follow up a different career with after Soundgarden. He kind of laid low and did some, you know, interesting things here and there with, you know, different collaborators, you know, that he was interested in doing things with. But yeah, maintain a low profile, you know, not like Ben. Ben did some stuff, a little bit here and there. And Matt, obviously, you know, became the drummer from Pearl Jam and became his calendar filled up for the end of time. And then Chris did what he did. Yeah. But Kim kind of went, you know, he went a little underground, for a while. And, you know, and then when Soundgarden reunited, I mean, it's nice to see lately, you know, he was working with the MC50, you know, the MC5, band that Wayne Kramer has put together, and he was doing stuff with that. And, you know, he just recently reunited with the Soundgarden guys the other night for that Alice in Chains tribute with Tad.
Well, they what did they do?
Oh, they did. I think they did Angry Chair together. Okay. The Alice in Chains song.
I gotta look that up. I've been seeing a lot of these other videos being shared on social media. I need to dig into that.
It was fantastic. They're all wearing masks. Mike McCready comes in with his blazing guitar solo too. It's phenomenal. Because hopefully what I guess I'm saying is, you know, Kim kept a low profile back then. I'm hoping that he doesn't do the same thing this time around, because, man, Kim-style riffs are awesome, and I hope we get more of them.
And I can't recall where I read this. I want to say it was a Rolling Stone or maybe Spin article about Soundgarden reuniting, but... And maybe I just have a bad memory. I swear there was a story, like, at the time when they first started meeting to kind of get the business stuff in order and all that kind of thing. Like, Ben Shepherd was living in like the office of a friend's bar.
Yeah, he'd fallen on rough times for sure. You know, I think that, you know, he had said, like, in an interview, he was homeless, and like that was kind of overstating it to some extent.
Okay.
But he wasn't in a great place. And then, you know, you know, he came back in Soundgarden and kind of put things back together. But, you know, it was that decade between, you know, Soundgarden's end and Soundgarden's renewal was very tough for him. Like, he got his bass that he used on all the Soundgarden records stolen. He had he made a record that got wiped or it got stolen or something too. Like, the masters were taken. Like, it was a long road for that guy. And, you know, I was so happy that when that band reunited, he got a second chance at that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he's a super talented guy too. You know what I mean? He's not just the bass player. If you get with my drift.
No.
And yeah, he wears the bass really low.
Yeah, he definitely does. Look at the writing credits on Down on the Upside, and you'll see Ben Shepherd's impact.
Oh yeah, I mean, and it started on Super Unknown. He had some key contributions there. When I did talk to Michael Beinhorn, I professed my love for the song Half. I know that kind of gets dumped on as kind of a throwaway track by some fans. I think that song is fantastic.
We can disagree on that one, but that's, I like Head Down. Head Down's good.
But, yeah, that too. Yeah, exactly. And they just, I don't know. Okay, fair enough. Well, but before I get to the next chapter, let me ask you this. Did you hear the Ultra Mega OK remix or the proper remix that Jack and Dino did, I assume?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have it on vinyl in my office right now.
It's phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
It's night and day. It's like I've owned that record since, you know, basically I got into all this music. I bought everything, and I just never gravitated to that record. Jack and Dino made that record sound like Soundgarden.
Yeah, I think the remastered version might be, you know, probably, I mean, personally, I would say Bad Motor Finger, Super Unknown, then Ultra Mega OK. Like I mentioned earlier, I love Led Zeppelin, and that's the most like Led Zeppelin-iest Soundgarden album in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I suppose. Over Louder Than Love, huh?
I think so, personally. I think that Louder Than Love can do with a remaster, if we're being kind of completely honest. There's some low end lacking on that album, I think.
Oh, I'm down for that, man.
Yeah, I think that it could add some new dimension to that one if they ever get around to it.
Kind of messed up I think it's pretty obvious, but I think I've even seen Chris state this, that you know, basically Big Dumb Sex is probably their poppiest, catchiest song, and it has the word fuck in it 47 times or so, whatever.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the thing, like, he wrote that song, and it was, like, obvious. Like, if he had written probably different lyrics, that could have been a huge breakout rock hit, but... It just, like, the integrity of the band or whatever, he, like, couldn't allow himself to do that. So he had to write, like, a toss-off song instead about, you know, don't you want to thrill me? All the innuendo that he put in there. It's just, you know, that's the way he rolled.
And the song "Loud Love," I use a snippet of it as the show intro, but it's one of my favorite intros of all time. That part where the feedbacking guitar just kind of morphs into this high pitched scream of Chris, where you almost don't even know where it transitions from guitar to his voice. It is like a hair in the back of the neck moment for me, man. Sometimes I listen to that song and I get just past that intro and I hit back. You know, I'm like, gotta hear that again.
Totally agree with you. Unless people think that I'm trying to slander Louder Than Love here. I love that song. I think I agree with you completely on the introduction there, just the way that wail goes in and underlying riff. But even more than that song Gun, I mean, if you saw Soundgarden live and they played Gun, you would remember it, because it starts off slow and sludgy and whatever in the beginning, but then it like goes in this break in that clip near the end, and it is one of the most mind-blowing experiences you'd ever see in your life.
So good. Getting to kind of the downer of this thing, Chris dies, of course, on May 17th, 2017. I saw them on May 13th, so 4 days before he died. I was covering the show for Decibel Geek. So I had a photo pass, and I got to see basically kind of my heroes right there. And so when I heard the news, obviously it was pretty jarring. I was like, holy fuck, I just submitted these to their management. And now the guy, so it just really was, I think almost across the board, it was unexpected the for everybody involved. You know what I mean?
Right. Totally. I no one saw that coming. I was just shocked as everyone else. I was working at Up Rocks at the time. And that morning it was awful having to write stories and kind of contemplate what that meant. It came so far out of nowhere that, to this day, I think that people are still trying to come to grips with it. I know I'm still trying to come to the grips with it, and I wrote a book about the guy. It was such a tragedy. It still remains such a tragedy.
Yeah, I read your breakdown on it three times, and because it kind of unearthed that kind of unsettled feeling I had about the whole thing, and now I feel like less connected to it. I don't know if that's the right way to say it. It's even more mystifying, I guess, just going through that. Let me ask you this. You talk about how after the last show, the band gets in the bus and starts heading towards the next city for the show, where Chris actually goes to a local hotel. Was that normal for them to just split like that?
It was, yeah. The band traveled by bus, and then Chris would kind of travel independently of the band. Like he had flown it. He had like a few days off before that gig, and he was in New York. I think he flew back into Detroit for that show.
Okay.
And he was going to stay the night and then go to Columbus, I think, the next gig in the solo, I think by plane.
And you mentioned the Instagram post, which I saw that day, which made it really did, especially anybody that like, you know, oh, hey, there's Chris Cornell. He's like posting like how fired up he is to play this show. And the next morning you wake up and you hear the news. It is just mystifying.
Yeah. And honestly, it will probably forever be mystifying to so many people. It's just one of those things where you, as much as you can look at it from so many different perspectives, it will always, you know, leave question marks and make you wonder what could have been and what might have been different, you know, if other circumstances. And you could drive yourself crazy kind of doing that. You know, I've lost people in my life to that, and some of the book is dedicated to some of those people.
Sure.
And I try to be as respectful of what that meant as I possibly could in the book. And I hope that, you know, people at least will understand what happened, even if they can't understand, the necessarily why behind it.
That is kind of the difficult thing. So hopefully I'm being respectful when I ask, you know, questions like this, because I'm not a guy looking for salacious dirt, but I'm just more or less trying to get some understanding, you know, and all this stuff. Is there any idea do you have any idea, how long it would have been from like when Vicky actually talked to Chris for a little bit, and then from that moment to when the bodyguard tried the first time, not when he kicked the door down, but when he tried to get in and found out that the door was locked from the inside.
Like the timeline's a bit hazy on all that stuff.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I think I have to look back at the police report and everything. I couldn't come up with an answer off the top of my head.
Okay. Well, he had quite a mix of substances in his system at the time. Ultimately, it was labeled suicide by hanging, with the coroner saying drugs didn't contribute to the cause of death. To me, that seems a bit simplistic. Any thoughts there?
Nah, not really.
Okay. I know we're getting to the dark stuff, and I'm okay if you don't want to dig into it. I'm just trying to do my end, too, you know.
Oh, no, totally. I understand. You know, there's all those questions will always come up, and, you know, I'm not a medical expert or anything like that. I wouldn't want to weigh in on something I don't really know too much about, you know.
All right. And well, then, so I can just explain for anybody listening, my point is state of mind can definitely plays a role in suicide, and to say that drugs had no role is, to me, a bit short-sighted. But the coroner's being a bit, I don't know, just very to the matter of fact, I guess, is all I'm getting at.
Right, and the Cornell Estate has a lawsuit pending against the doctor prescribing the medication. You know, so I think that they would probably agree with your assessment.
Okay, good enough. The last line of the book, I got to tell you, man, it put chills on the back of my neck. I'm reading it as I'm talking to you right now. It's brilliant, and I'm still feeling it. You simply put, no one sings like him anymore. Kudos, I guess is all I got to say there. That was the perfect line.
Thank you so much. And it's true, honestly. You know, I'm not going to give too much away, but, you know, I attended the tribute concert that was held in 2019 in the LA Forum, and all these great, phenomenal, world-class performers came on stage and sung all these Chris songs, from Soundgarden to solo career, Audioslave to Temple of the Dog, and Brandi Carlile and Dave Grohl and Miley Cyrus, and just unbelievable singers, Chris Stapleton, but you couldn't help but feel, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if the guy walked through the door, he would have dusted them all. He had a voice and a power like no one else. And, you know, there's definitely a Chris Cornell shaped hole in the world that I don't think anyone will be able to fill anytime soon.
Did you ever meet Chris?
Briefly, once in LA, when he did an event, with Jimmy Page, for Jimmy Page's book he had, put out in 2014, I think.
Okay.
Met him briefly there, seen him multiple times and interviewed multiple people around him, but didn't get the pleasure to kind of really sit down and as a biographer, I would have loved to have had more time with him than I had, but, you know, it goes.
Well, I think you kind of answered this one, but I'm going to just ask you, give you a chance to maybe elaborate more. After spending so much time researching this book and writing it, you know, specifically about Chris, did you almost get to feel like, even though you didn't know him that well, that you did?
I think that it's a kind of a byproduct. You know, I wouldn't want to insult anyone who did know Chris to the level of a Kemp Dial
or
his family or friends or anything like that. I wouldn't claim to know him to that level. But, you know, you read his words, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of words for years. You talk to people who knew him, and you can feel the imprint that he's on their lives. And you can't help but know or feel, you know, him in some sort of way and kind of get into his headspace and how he wrote and, you know, his values and things. And I definitely, there's a version of Chris in my head that I think that that it will always kind of exist and be there. And I'll always admire and return to it. I listen to those records. And, you know, I grew very fond of him, as you might expect. Just because, you know, he was an uncompromising dude who, you know, went from a high school dropout who had drug problems from the time he was a kid, who, you know, I don't think anyone expected to really to make it and turn into one of the greatest rock stars of the last 50 years. It's a remarkable story, and he did it in a remarkable way with some remarkable talent. And I my admiration for him only grew as I learned more about him while writing the book.
There is an interview with him that it's very brief, but it's one of my favorites, and it's early on, around 90. It's before he cut his hair. Let's put it that way. He is it's at a European festival of some sort, and he's it's rainy, and he's interviewed under a tent by some guy, and he is polite and curt all at the same time, and it's just, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. I wish I could give you a better description, but to me, it really kind of sums up a lot about what I like about the guy. He just had you touched on it just a second ago with how he really was uncompromising in almost pretty much everything he did artistically mattered to him.
Oh, absolutely. He didn't suffer fools, but he also did the things that he needed to do. You know, he took his responsibility seriously. And even that meant suffering through, you know, the myriad of interviews, you know, asking, you know, what's it like to be friends with Kurt Cobain? And did he had to right. go through, I'm sure, multiple times in the 90s. And, you know, what was Andrew Wood like? And rehashing all the stories. And he was always down to do it. He may not always give the most verbose guy, but in the times that he opened up, he was very revealing. You know, he kind of gave you glimpses of himself, but he was also very private, very, very, especially in the 90s, very, very private dude, to the point where he's like shopping for records at Easy Street here in Seattle, like after hours with a ball cap pulled down, just to kind of some semblance of, you know, privacy. And you can imagine being Chris Cornell living in Seattle, you know, it's, he's like 6'2" or whatever. It's hard to miss that guy.
Exactly. He'd be pretty easy to pick out even in a crowd,
sure.
Corbin, I had a blast. You're actually very good at this. You should do more of these.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah. You're very entertaining. You had some insight. I guarantee the listeners are going to love it. So thank you for coming on. Thank you for your time. People, you can find the book Total Fucking Godhead everywhere, right?
Yeah. Everywhere. Amazon, independent record stores, independent bookstores, wherever they buy books, you can find that book. I'm sure that you, I hope that you enjoy it if you do pick it up.
Yeah, and I'll give my own endorsement. It's one of the better rock biographies I've read. It's very thorough. Like I had told you before we started here, there wasn't a lot of like questions I came away with because you did a really good job of kind of detailing most of the things that are important in Chris's life. So, well done.
Well, thank you. So I'm so stoked to hear that. I appreciate you, and thanks for having me on. I do appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Yeah. All right. Right on, Corbin. Anything else to pitch?
No, that's it for right now. I might have something later, but we'll be in touch.
Okay. All right, Corbin. Have a good evening, man.
You too. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, but say, hey, I'm Corbin Reef. I'm probably the best looking guy you've never met. Something like that, you know, whatever you want to say, like however you want to promote yourself. Like,
it's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.